Good morning, everybody. Today I want to continue our sutta study course. Today is the second day, September 23rd. Yesterday, Panti Rahula mentioned in our discussion that noble search was ended in one way, and Satcha Vibhanga Sutta, Sutta number 36, I think, ended in a different way, and therefore there doesn't seem to be a consistency. But at that time, my response was not satisfactory, I believe, for me at least. Then I reflect upon it, and I found the solution, satisfactory solution. That is, if you read in number 26, Noble Search, there is an additional section called Sensual Pleasures. So when you read that section, you see the section is Buddha used the third person as to those, five courses. Because there are these five courses of sensual pleasures. What are the five? And then he went on explaining. And he said, a bhikkhu abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body. He enters upon and abides in the third jhana and so forth. You can read the rest of the things. Then he says, he enters upon and abides in the third jhana. So, in the first section, he said, I shall instruct you, I shall teach you the Dhamma, practicing as you are instructed by realizing for yourself here and now. Through direct knowledge, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forward from the homeless life into homelessness. So that section Buddha ended on page 266. In explaining the his reluctance to teach the Dhamma, he says, these people, those died in lust, wrapped in darkness, will never discern this abstruse Dhamma, which goes against the worldly stream, subtle, deep, and difficult to see. So in the first line he said, those died in lust. This is the place, this is the thing that he explained in the last section of this discourse. For the bhikkhus to understand what this lust is. So he went on explaining sensual pleasures. This is an additional to the first section. Therefore, consistency is there right up to the end of the first discourse. And this is an additional part. To make his point clear, he brought this additional section. You can see the way Buddha used the person first. In the first section, he used the first person. Last section, he used the third person. And therefore, there is no inconsistency even there. So don't blame the Buddha. Today, also yesterday I did not mention one thing. We did not end Bodhirajakumara Sutta yesterday because we didn't have time. I want to draw your attention to Bodhiraja Sutta, how it ended. In several suttas like Mahasatipatthana Sutta, Satipatthana Sutta, and Udumbarika Sihanada Sutta and so forth, Buddha gave a 7-day minimum guarantee. From 7 years to 7 days. If you practice ardently, mindfully, following his instructions exactly as he given, as he has given, then such a person can attain either full enlightenment or the third level of enlightenment within 7 days or 7 years. He made an exception to that in Bodhirajakumara Sutta. In Bodhirajakumara Sutta he said, there are 2 points. I also want to mention another thing, which we did not mention when we were discussing Bodhirajakumara Sutta. That was when Buddha was entering the palace of Bodhirajakumara. He spread a white cloth for the Buddha to walk. That even we do in, particularly in Sri Lanka, when monks go to a house, people spread white cloths for the monks to walk on. Not only for monks, even big elephant in Kandy that carries the tooth relic casket on its back, they spread white cloths for this elephant to walk. This elephant is so well trained, so obedient, so respectful. This huge elephant walk on this white cloth. When he comes to the end, he stops until they put the white cloth for the rest of the road. He was so conscientious. So in Sri Lanka, people do this out of great respect for monks and nuns. And this practice started in the time of the Buddha by Bodhirajakumara. When he spread the white cloth on the floor, he had a different intention. He thought, because he was childless, he thought if Buddha stepped on this white piece of cloth, his wife definitely was going to be pregnant. They would definitely have a baby. Buddha walked and came to the palace, near the palace, near the steps, near the cloth, and he stopped. He did not step on the white piece of cloth. Prince Bodhi requested the Buddha to step on it 3 times. Buddha did not say one word, did not lift his foot, he simply stood there. Bodhiraja must have been very disappointed. Then Buddha looked at Venerable Ananda Ananda asked the Bodhiraja to remove the piece of cloth. So that is the part, but there are various other interpretations in commentaries. One interpretation is that Buddha did not want people to have a superstition. Because if they had this kind of superstition, in future, Buddha thought, in future, people will use monks to fulfill their superstitious beliefs. And if they don't come true, they will blame the monks. And Buddha did not want that to happen. Therefore, Buddha passed a special rule in Chullavagga, in Dukkata Apatti section, that if a monk steps on a piece of cloth spread by people on the floor, that is for offense of wrongdoing, Dukkata. Then what happened after some times? Another very pious religious woman offered dana, and that day she spread the white piece of cloth, not knowing this rule, spread the white piece of cloth on the floor. And since bhikkhus knew this rule already that Buddha has already introduced, refused to step on it. She complained. She said, "I spread this piece of cloth nothing but out of respect for them. I want to respect. I want to get blessing. Why didn't they step on the piece of cloth?" Then Buddha thought, yes, if they have respect for bhikkhus and bhikkhunis and spread white piece of cloth for them to walk, then they should walk. Then he'll change the rule. You can find both rules in the Chullavagga Dukkata section. That is one point I forgot to mention yesterday. Since people have seen this practice in, especially in Sri Lanka, now they will know why we do that, why they do it. Second point I wanted to mention from that particular discourse is the 7-day Buddha's guarantee. He changed that. And he introduced 5 additional samadhi anga. That is, if somebody have these 5 qualities, such as faith, good health, 100% honesty, energy, and a possessing of wisdom. Suppose somebody has these 5 qualities. What are they? Faith, good health, honesty, energy, and possessing of wisdom. Buddha said, when he instructed this individual in the morning, evening he will attain enlightenment by following instructions. If he instructed somebody in the evening, next morning he will attain enlightenment. So these 7 days he reduced to 1.5 day. So Buddha was so convinced that this method, this system is so effective, so potent, if somebody very honestly practices, this will happen. Now, this is what I wanted to mention from yesterday's leftover. And today we want to start Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta it is called turning the wheel of discourse. You saw the way how Buddha prepared these five ascetics to listen to this discourse. The five ascetics were hesitant, skeptical, did not believe the Buddha at the first time. And Buddha had to repeat three times, bhikkhus, in the first place don't call me ahuso, don't call me friend in the first place, because I am little more than a friend. Therefore, calling me a friend may not be appropriate. It is disrespectful. So he had to convince them, telling the same thing three times. Finally, he thought of convincing them in a very firm way. He said, bhikkhus, you have been associating with me. He addressed these friends as bhikkhus now. They all were ascetics. They were never ordained, wearing shaving head and wearing yellow clothes. They were wearing their regular ascetic cloth. And nowhere have we come across that they had shaved their head like the Buddha. Siddhartha Gautama said, you have already read in the Noble Search, that while his parents were crying, shedding tears, while they were very sad, he left home, shaven his head, and became an ascetic. Buddha was the only one who mentioned that. About other ascetics, there is no such record. And yet, they all were ascetics, practicing together. When the Buddha met them after his attainment of enlightenment, they still were exactly as they were. But Buddha called them bhikkhus. And addressed bhikkhus, have I ever told you, for the last 6 years that I have been associating with you, do you remember once that I told you that I have attained enlightenment? When Buddha made this lion roar, at that moment, these five ascetics became speechless. And they said, now they said, no more friend, also. Now they said, no venerable sir. First time they said to the Buddha, venerable sir. Then he delivered his sermon. This sermon you find in translation. We have memorized this sermon in Pali. I don't want to say it in Pali now. If you like, we can recite together one day. But today let me draw your attention to the translation. In Sanyutta Nikaya translation, page 1843, onward you can see the translation. So thus have I heard Venerable Ananda's report. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savat as Benares in Deer Park at Isipatana. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus or the group of five thus: "Bhikkhus, these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What to?" These words are very important to remember, because this is the heart of Buddha's teaching. The first sermon was repeated. Every letter of this sermon is very important. The message in this discourse was repeated 84,000 times. Recorded suttas are 18,000 suttas recorded. Others are little words here and there, phrases here and there, passages here and there, all put together. There is a belief that there were 84,000 sermons. I have never come across this 84 in any particular record. I believe there must have been that many. That many times this message was repeated in 84,000 different ways, not in one single way. It is given in this sutta here in one way. He said, what are the two extremes? The pursuit of sensual pleasures in sensual pleasures, sensual happiness in sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. These words are different from the rest, other extreme. The other extreme is the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. Now, who follow these two extremes? Buddha asked, who should avoid these two extremes? By one who has gone forth into homelessness. Remember, by one who has gone forth from home to homelessness should avoid these two extremes. Now, this does not apply to people who have not left home. This is specifically mentioned in the discourse itself. Two extremes should be avoided by those who have gone forth into homelessness. Without understanding this very first opening sentence, many people get confused. They said, how can we live with our families if we follow these instructions? Here instructions is specifically given to those who have left home, those who want to pursue a different mode of life. Their purpose is to live a sort of a religious life. And therefore they should avoid this. First is sensual pleasure, the happiness of sensual pleasures. When we avoid happiness of sensual pleasure, then he opens the possibility for another kind of happiness. Buddha did not deny all kind of happiness. For those who have left home, there is another kind of happiness, not the happiness of sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings. The worldlings are engaged in these things, but those who have left home are not worldlings anymore, and therefore they are the ones who must avoid this. unbeneficial? Unbeneficial for the attainment of their goal. Their goal is not material, sensual, pleasure-oriented goal. And the pursuit of unbeneficial, low and vulgar, ignoble, and the other is pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. He did not say self-mortification vulgar, nor did he say it is worldlings, but he simply said self-mortification is painful, ignoble, definitely. Now, without veering towards either of these two extremes, the Tathagata was awakened to the middle path, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. We have repeated this many, many times in our Vandana book. And what bhikkhus is the middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to vision and so forth? It is this same right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right and right concentration. Now, honestly speaking, friends, no other tradition in the entire religious field, religious history, has given very clear-cut outline, the plan, design, a method, a system as the Buddha has given. And it is mentioned in the first sermon. So, this Noble Eightfold Path is not developed gradually, one upon the other, through trial and error, through various experimentations, through various discussions, asking people questions. No. The very first opening sermon itself, Buddha said, this is the path, this is the method, this is the system. And he never changed this. He never changed this, and we can never change it. The more we expound this, the deeper we'll have understanding be. This bhikkhus is that middle way awakened to the Tathagata, which gives rise to vision, knowledge, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and Nibbana. Now, this bhikkhus is the noble truth of suffering. Now, as I mentioned, why it is called noble truth? Why suffering is there anything noble in suffering for it to be called noble truth? What is noble in suffering? There's nothing noble in it. But the truth is noble. Suffering is a truth. This truth is noble. Why it is noble? Because you can never change it. It is true then as well as it is now. Therefore, the truth is noble, truth is holy, not the suffering itself. But unfortunately, suffering happened to be the truth. Birth is suffering. Nobody denies that. Of course, we celebrate birth. Nobody cries birth. When we are born, on our birthday, we were very delighted. Why we celebrate? Because we want to forget that suffering. So we want to celebrate it, to cover it up, to forget, ignore, sweep under the rug. We don't want to remember it, so we celebrate it. We don't say that, but the real true psychology is that we don't want to remember this very painful moment in our life and the moment that initiated our pain. The suffering initiated at the moment of birth. And we don't want to remember that. Aging is suffering. Can anybody deny that? Can anybody say no, no? Aging is a blessing, a pleasure. Maybe a pleasure for children, because they like to grow, because they are ignorant. Once they grown up, they regret. Gee, I would have been very nice if I stayed young. I can play all day long. Now, so many responsibilities, so many obligations. I can see so many problems in life. So, only when we mature, we begin to see the reality. When we are not, we enjoy it. Then, illness is suffering. Can anybody enjoy illness? Can I say, I really am delighted I'm sick? Can anybody say that? Somebody who is working very hard in the office might say, I am delighted, I am sick, I can rest in bed. That is not real pleasure. Even at that time the person cannot say that. So, death is suffering. That is the worst. Nobody, even the approach to death itself is suffering. Thought of death is suffering. If you were to say to somebody, while having a very pleasant moment, enjoying life, you say, I want to die. The other person says, you are crazy. Don't tell that kind of foolish things. Let us enjoy. In the middle of enjoyment, one person would say, I want to die now. Would you like that? He said, you are crazy. Let us enjoy. Because nobody wants to hear the word death. But Buddha really, you know, hammered the truth right into our mind. So, death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. That is very true. Very true. You have to work with your very mean boss. You enjoy that? You have to work with very mean co-worker. Do you enjoy it? Never. So, not to get what one wants is suffering. What we don't want, we don't want aging, we don't want, but we get it. Sickness we don't want, we get it. And I think we can put it the other way also. Suppose we want something very pleasant, very beautiful, very meaningful, expensive, Everybody appreciates it. We want to get it. Are we happy? So, no. So we can say, not to get what one wants is suffering, and to get what one wants also is suffering. Because when you get what you want, you have to maintain it, support it, ensure it, safeguard it, protect it, take care of it. Is it not suffering? So there is no escape. We are trapped. And people don't like to hear this. And then, in brief, I think you like this. The five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. How can we escape? We have it. Five aggregates. We have. What are the five aggregates? Form, feeling, perceptions, volitional formations, and consciousness. So long as we have these five, we have suffering. So this is called Paticca Samuppada, eva metasya kevalasya dukkha khandasya samudayo hoti. Thus, this whole mass of suffering arises. Mass of suffering means five aggregates. Five aggregates is called dukkha khanda. Aggregates of suffering. Now, here, arising of suffering is mentioned, but the way the suffering arises is explained with some detail in Paticca Samuppada, dependent origination. Buddha did not spell it out here, but when he attained the full enlightenment, on the night he attained enlightenment, it was that truth he realized. And this suffering arises depending on those factors we see in the dependent origination. Remember I mentioned he saw his previous lives to the infinitum, and he saw the lives of other individuals dying and taking rebirth according to their karma. Then this Bodhisattva, who is still now striving to attain enlightenment, and then he began to wonder, why is this happening? Why was I born so many times? Why are so and so taking birth so many times? Then he saw the cause and conditions, dependent origination. That is the time he really thought of dependent origination. That night, seeing his previous lives, seeing others taking birth after death, he began to wonder why. And then he saw the real cause of birth. And that whole series is called dependent origination. Now, this bhikkhus is the noble truth of suffering, noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for extermination. Now, cause of suffering he found as a craving. In dependent origination, cause of suffering is ignorance. Here, cause of suffering is greed, desire. He described the desire, the cause of suffering, craving, which is which renews existence. That is the function of craving. It renews. In order to renew it, we do many, many, many things. So after doing all kind of things with craving, we cannot stop renewal. We will be renewed. And renewed existence accompanied by delight and lust. That is the nature of craving. Craving is so delightful. And underneath craving, there is lust. Seeking delight here and there. One word for craving is called porno-bhavika. That Pali word conveys the real full meaning. Porno-bhavika. Porna is puna. Puna means again. Bhavika means becoming. The very nature of craving is renewing, re-becoming again and again. Porno-bhavika. Punarbhava in Sanskrit, punarbhava. Punarbhavika in Sanskrit. Pali, porno-bhavika. Very good Pali term for craving. Craving for sensual pleasure. And that craving has three aspects. What are the three? Craving for sensual pleasure. I think all living beings crave for sensual pleasure without any exception. The second is craving for existence. When we enjoy sensual pleasure, we are so engrossed in it, so obsessed with it, that we want to perpetually exist. We want to continue this sensual pleasure forever. That is why when some people are very much attached to each other, they say, when they die, let us be reborn again to be the same partners, to be together. Because even in the next life they want to be together. And that life when they die, they might say, let us be together next life. So their clutch is so strong, they don't want to let it go. This is called craving for existence. So in this life we try everything possible to enjoy pleasure, and we can never satisfy it, then we think maybe next life. Whatever we could not do in this life, next life. When that life ends, we find there have been many millions of new things we have not explored, not enjoyed. Then we desire, maybe next life. If that life comes, the same thing. Then we think, maybe next life. So the needs increases every day, and desire can never keep up with the need. And this kind of craving is called craving for existence. And then there is another craving for extermination. To stop. That also is a craving. Since it is not going to happen, this craving continues to exist. This is the materialist's craving, materialist belief that this is the only life. Eat, drink and be happy. There's no more life. That is their wish. But underneath that wish, there is a desire to enjoy life, here or there. That, in fact, is called the craving for existence is called eternalism. Craving for non-existence or extermination of existence is nihilism. Eternalism is held by religious people. Nihilism is held by materialists. They are not spiritualists. And by the way, the word spiritualism, we don't like to use that because that has many different connotations. Spiritualist and so forth in modern society, we hear the word spiritualist. But that word, we don't mean that word. What that word means is not what we mean. Spiritualist means people who practice religions. They have faith. They believe karma, rebirth, and so forth. For want of better term, we use whatever the word people already are using. Then, now this bhikkhu says the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. So he explained first, see the way the Buddha laid down everything in such a beautiful way. First he gave the whole outline. Then he goes step by step, one by one, spelling out to show the entire detailed plan. I mean, it is amazing. One must be fully enlightened to come up with this first sermon. In the first sermon itself, putting things out, laid down so perfectly, whole flow plan, so beautifully. And then he said, so he showed what suffering is and what is its cause. And then he comes to show us what is the cessation, how to stop it. Now this bhikkhus is the noble truth of cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. These words are very important. Remainderless fading, asesa viraga. Asesa viraga, no sesa. When you make mathematics, you know, if there is little fraction, you call that's a remainder. There is no such remainder, no even any decimal point left. Everything must be without leaving one single iota left. Everything must be totally wiped out. The other day, yesterday, somebody asked me the question, how about little craving? Remember? Somebody asked the question, how about little craving? Buddha has no any sympathy for that. He said, not even one iota. She said, remainderless, asesa viraga, totally, completely, abandoning, cessation of that same craving. What is that same craving? The craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for non-existence. All these three types of cravings, We cannot keep one and let go the other two. Or let go of two and keep one. Let go of all the three types of cravings. Giving up, relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it, but he has not left. He's like a lawyer. When lawyers draw an agreement or something, they use every possible term without leaving one single room for you to sneak in. The Buddha was like that, giving the whole series of words to cover up everything so that you cannot question, how about this, how about that? He did not leave out anything. He is not, I don't call him a lawyer, it is an insult to the Buddha, but but the way he laid down things are so perfect. Then he showed four steps now. First, the suffering. Second, the cause of suffering. Third, the end of suffering. And the fourth. Now this bhikkhus is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is this same noble eightfold path that is outlined at the beginning as the middle path. Noble eightfold path and middle path are not two different things. Sometimes it is called middle path because it avoids two extremes. Sometimes it is called noble eightfold path because it has eight steps. See, another very precise, perfect realization of the Dhamma, enlightened, not the Buddha, he did not say, maybe there may be seven, maybe six, or maybe nine. No, he directly said, there are only eight steps. Noble eightfold path. Did not say sevenfold path, sixfold path, and so forth. Everything is well planned far in advance. Now, then, this is the beauty. Then Buddha wanted to convince this bhikkhus, after showing these four, he wanted to convince this bhikkhus how he perfected these four. He perfected them in this way. The first, there are what you call three faces and 12 aspects. First he showed the three faces, because each truth has three faces. What are the three faces? Theoretical face, practical face, and accomplishing the practice, the completing the practice. That is theory, the practice, and completing the practice. It is just like going to a class, learning the theory, and then you go to the lab to practice it, experiment it, and then come out with the result. So he laid down these three phases. First, he said, this is the noble truth of suffering. Thus, bhikkhus, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. There's no doubt. He said, this is the truth which nobody has declared before. Nobody even has heard before, unheard. In his time, there were many religious teachers. Not one single of them came out and declared to the world, this is suffering. Nobody said. So he said, he discovered it and concluded this is suffering. That is the theory. And with this theory, what arose? There arose in me vision. Vision arose. Chakkum udapadi. Chakku, the word chakku is used for the eyes. In Pali Buddha says chakkum udapadi. I arose in me. What is the function of eye? Seeing. So, he summarized it using the word vision. Vision arose in me. Then, he said, knowledge arose in me. Wisdom arose in me. And true knowledge and light arose. Aloko udapadi. Light arose in me. Pali word is chakkum udapadi, jnanam udapadi, vidya udapadi, aloko udapadi. Chakkum udapadi, panya udapadi. Chakkum udapadi, panya udapadi, vidya udapadi, aloko udapadi. Jnanam? Yeah, chakkum udapadi, jnanam udapadi. Panya Uddhapadi, Vidya Uddhapadi, Aloka Uddhapadi. Yeah. He used the word both Panya and Jnana. Yes, Panya is knowledge, Jnana is wisdom. What is the difference between Panya, knowledge and wisdom? Both appear to be synonymous, but they are there's a shade of meaning between these two words. Knowledge is what you have, what we acquire from outside, through experiments, through observations, through testing, through search, research, and so forth, studies, memorizing, and so forth, we gain knowledge. But wisdom arises intuitively within oneself. It is more intuition, and it is fused when knowledge arose. It is vision. The wisdom was previously it was just potential, and potential wisdom became kinetic wisdom, really practical, usable wisdom. So, when it is dormant, it is one intuitive. When it is powered, it is wisdom. Powered by knowledge.
What's the difference between knowledge and true knowledge?
True knowledge is knowledge of the truth. Yes. First is vidya, jnana, the other is panya, the other is vidya. Vidya is true knowledge, jnana is knowledge, panya is wisdom. Now, theoretical understanding and wisdom arising from powering the intuition, and true knowledge arises by seeing the truth of these four steps. And then light arose. Light was as Buddha mentioned in other places in Anguttara Nikaya, our mind is luminous. This mind is luminous. And because of the adventitious defilement, it becomes corrupted. And when adventitious defilements are totally, completely removed, it begins to shine. That is how light arises in us. And that is what happened to him when he realized the Four Noble Truths and Dependent Origination. All, and following these steps of the Noble Eightfold Path, all his stains, defilements, external impurities were removed, and the mind immediately began to brightly shine itself. Its natural luminosity became explicit. I think vision, nowadays the word insight is used for vipassana. I think there is a shade of meaning close to each other, vision and insight, yeah. Then the next one, this is the first of the three phases. First of the three phases is the knowing this is true. Second of the three phases is the theory. Then that means when the knowledge of truth arises, then the person should know what should do with the knowledge. That is the function. And these three in Pali, theory, practice and accomplishment of the practice, these three are called in Pali Satcha Kiccha Katha. Satcha, S-A-C-C-A, Satcha, the truth. Kiccha, K-I-C-C-A, Kiccha is function, the theory, the duty of that thing. Khata means accomplished, completed, fulfilled. Khata, K-A-T-A. So the first one is Satcha. The second is this noble truth of suffering is to be fully understood. That is the function. It should be fully understood. Yeah?
Isn't there another way of saying that? It's like the first one would be pariyati.
Right. Exactly. There are three other words. Pariyati, patipatti, pativeda. Very good. Thank you very much for reminding us. Pariyati is the theory. Patipatti is the practice. Pativeda is realization. And those are the Pali words. English word I put in English, pariyatti is the theory, patipatti is the practice, pativeda is the realization. You gave me the Pali, the clue to Pali words, but I gave their English equivalent earlier. Either pariyatti, patipatti, pativeda, or satcha, kiccha, katha, or theory, practice, and accomplishment. Then the second is with regard to this unheard before and so forth, the same. And the third is, third phase is, this noble truth of suffering has been fully understood. That is the accomplishment, completed, katha. Done, finished. Then the next phase, next three phases, this noble truth of the origin of suffering is the knowledge, pariyatti or satcha, the truth. And same thing he repeated, thus because in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, true knowledge, and light. We don't have to repeat this again and again, but this is to be understood. The second of the second noble truth, or patipatti, or kicca, function, is this noble truth of origin of suffering is to be abandoned. What is the second noble truth? Is desire, which is to be, which is the origin, and that is to be abandoned. That is its function, patipatti, practice. And the third is, this noble truth of origin of suffering has been abandoned, completed. That is katha, pativedha, realization, and accomplishment. Then the third noble truth, this is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. That is the truth, what you call satya, theory, or pariyatti. Then the second phase of that truth is, this noble truth of cessation of suffering is to be realized. That is the function, practice, patipatti. And the third of the third phase of that is, this noble truth of cessation of suffering has been realized. That is the katha, or pativedha, or accomplishment. Then the fourth truth. This is the noble truth of the way leading to cessation of suffering, is the truth, the theory, satya, pariyatti. Second is this noble truth of the way leading to cessation of suffering is to be developed. Is to be developed. That is the function, the patipatti, practice, or kicca. Now, to be developed, when we have something to be developed, in that we have karma practice, meditation practice, jhana practice, right speech, action, livelihood, understanding, everything is to be practiced. All these are to be practiced, not to be kept in a cupboard and locked, but put them into practice. So that is the theory. Then the second, this noble truth of suffering and truth of the way leading to cessation of suffering has been, no. Third is has been developed. When he completed the practice, we can say we have realized it. That is pativedha, khata. And then he said, having done all this, he has done all these things before he met these monks, and he said to these monks, because, so this is his real line roar. He says, so long bhikkhus, as my knowledge and vision of these four noble truths as they really are, in their three phases and 12 aspects was not thoroughly purified in this way, I did not claim to have knowledge, have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world with its devas, Mara, the Brahma, in this generation with these aspects, as ascetics and Brahmins, is devas and humans. So he said, Yavaki vanjaso bikremesu chadusu aryasachyu shevam tiparivartan dvadasagaran yatabhutan jnanadasanam na suvi suddhang ahosi nevatavaham bikke sadevake loke samadake sabrahmake sas samana brahmaniya pajaya sade manusaya anuttaran samma sambodhin abhisambodhan buddhoti pachanyasin. This is the meaning of that. Because so long as bhikkhus, my knowledge and vision of these four noble truths as they really are, in their three phases and 12 aspects, was not thoroughly purified in this way. Not half purified, thoroughly purified. He had a full 100% perfect knowledge, perfect confidence. He said, I did not claim to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world with these devas. There are devas who are watching, looking, you know, to see whether I'm telling the truth. Mara is looking, watching to see whether I am telling the truth. Brahma is waiting, watching, looking to see whether I am telling the truth. And generation with the ascetics, various ascetics who have divine eyes, divine reading others' thoughts, very many supernatural powers, they are there waiting, looking, seeing, watching, to see whether I am telling the truth. Brahmins always were waiting to find faults, criticize. They are waiting. Among these individuals, these powerful beings, this I never declare this until this perfectly clear in my mind, in these three phases and 12 aspects. Is devas and himas. But when my knowledge and vision of these four noble truths as they really are, in their three phases and 12 aspects, was thoroughly purified in this way, then I claim to have knowledge to unsurpass perfect enlightenment in this world with its devas, Mara and Brahma, in this generation with its aspects and ascetics and human Brahmins, its devas and humans, the knowledge and vision arose in me. Unshakable is the liberation of my mind. Friends, I feel so thrilled with the Buddha's powerful declaration. He did not simply appear in the world, I had a vision. He said, and believe me, follow me, I have a vision. No. He gave the plan. When he came out, he gave the plan. This is what I realized. And you follow it, you can realize that too. He came with such a full confidence. I mean, when you think about this, you will see, really see the profundity of his understanding and depth of his understanding, clarity, purity of his mind. He had such a courage, such a guts, such a power to tell the world, which was waiting for him, to tell the truth. Unchallengeable, the truth he declared. And remember, when he was practicing self-mortification, he mentioned several times, unshakable is my mind. He mentioned, remember, I reminded you when we were talking about self-mortification, he was practicing, you know, stopping breath and not eating. He reduced to skeleton. He fell down and so forth and so on. At every stage, he said, my mind remained unshakable. My mind remained pure and clean. He never got confused. Even under those such a dire, difficult moments of practicing self-mortification. So all alone in his life, from childhood until he attained full enlightenment, he showed the silver line. No time in his life, even as a layperson, even as a little boy, had he had any moment of confusion. This is why we trust the Buddha. So, this is what he said. Then after that, there are a lot of other things happen. This is what the Blessed One said. Elated, the bhikkhus of the group of five. Now, I mention this discourse at this moment because in Arya Pariyasana Sutta, Buddha did not, the sutta, in that sutta itself, this has not been incorporated. In that sutta, Buddha said, I instructed, I persuaded them that I have attained enlightenment, and then they listened, and then I instructed. What did he instruct? What did he tell? This is what he told. He instructed two at a time, while other three went on collecting alms food. When they returned with food, all the six, the Buddha and the five ascetics, shared that food. Next day, three went out and then collected food and came back. And while they were out collecting food, Buddha gave instructions to these two. When they came back, they shared the food, all of them, and all the six ate that food. And he continued to give this sermon repeatedly, again and again and again and again, for almost a whole month, until these monks memorized every word of this discourse. It is not a one-time shot and run away. He drilled the idea into their minds, taking turns every day for a whole month. And at the end, this is how he trained people. He was never tired of giving instructions and telling. When people ask questions, he never said, oh, I'm tired, go away, come tomorrow. He never did that. Remember when he was going to pass away, he was on his deathbed. He had diarrhea, he had dehydration. After dehydration, he also had passing blood. It's extremely weak. And just going to pass away. One man came called Subhadda. And he said, I have a burning question I want to ask the Buddha before he passes away. If he passes away, it will be too late. I will not have anybody to answer my question. Please. Venerable Ananda said, No. He is very tired, very weak. Please don't ask any question. Buddha overheard that. And he said, Ananda, let him come. I still can answer his question. You see? Even at that moment, he was ready. Body was tired. Mind was never tired. Always ready to give instructions. Friends, I forgot our break because if we had a break, then our flow would have been interrupted. So I hope you don't mind. having this session without a break. Now we have almost half an hour. Should we have a break?